Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., Emmett Till's cousin, best friend, and the last surviving witness of the night Till was lynched, discusses his book, A Few Days Full of Trouble, with co-author Christopher Benson. The following conversation originally took place March 16th, 2023, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Thank you all for being here and supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. Tonight's program is offered in conjunction with our ongoing exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. One of the catalyzing events of the century which that exhibit covers was the lynching of Emmett Till and Americans' response to that crime. In A Few Days Full of Trouble, Till's cousin, the Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., tells the story of Till's murder. He's the last living witness to Till's final days, and the book collects family memories, insights into the criminal investigation of the case, and powerful lessons for racial reckoning both then and now. Reverend Parker is joined here tonight with author Christopher Benson, Emmy Award-winning lawyer, journalist, and associate professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Please join me in welcoming them both.
Thank you, Allison, for that introduction, and thanks to everyone involved here at the museum for this extraordinary exhibition and for including us in this story. We think is a very important story in the context of the history of Black authors and the history of this country. So we're here to talk about Emmett Till from the perspective of the last person who has the complete story. It's interesting that so many people have talked about Emmett Till recently, and so people believe they know everything about Emmett Till, but you can't possibly know it until you've heard the story as told by a survivor of the night of terror, Emmett's cousin and best friend, who participated in a four-year-long investigation just recently that wound up based on evidence that people thought they had, but we'll tell you more about that as we talk about it. So the book, A Few Days Full of Trouble, which is drawn from the Bible, we'll talk about that too, because Reverend Wheeler Parker is keen on translating scripture to some of the real world events that we're experiencing. So with that, I just want to ask you, Reverend Parker, why did you want to write this book after almost 70 years of living with the story?
Yeah. That's a good question, and sometimes I wonder myself. For 30 years after Emmett's death, I was never interviewed, not that I should have been or wanted to be, but and shortly after he was killed, there was a Look magazine article where the killers told the story. And I was a kid, for some reason, I grew up thinking that grown people didn't lie. I heard one lady said, this lady told a lie. I said, grown people don't have to lie. Children lie to get out of trouble. And I really believed that. I mean, I was very naive, I guess, and thought everybody told the truth, and I was kind of bent on telling the truth. And I read the article in the Look magazine, and they're portraying Emmett in such a negative, and a lot of writers did, that it really impacted me until this day. I still don't have closure on that like I would like to. So as time went by, and kind of long story short, I came to the conclusion I need to tell my story. And to my surprise, when I told my story, they said, I alleged. I thought I knew what the word alleged meant, but how can you say an eyewitness alleged? Mark Twain said, an eyewitness will destroy a good story. I was not trying to destroy a good story, but America had accepted the Look magazine, all those negative stories told about Emmett Till. And I felt very helpless until I began to tell the story. And then there were some people took interest and said, well, maybe someone will believe me. And maybe someone will accept. I'm not a Look magazine person or person of that nature, but so from that encouragement, I had one cousin named Dr. Sheila Chamberlain. She just insisted. I said, I'm going to tell her. And she was relentless. She would never let up. And here I am, told the story. And from my perspective, and some people believe it.
Well, I certainly believe it. And we hope you all have a chance to share this experience, this journey of 4 years. It took basically a lifetime to fully understand, as Reverend Parker is suggesting. But you mentioned the Look magazine article. I think we might want to spend a moment talking about that. This is a magazine article that was written just a few months after Emmett Till, two of the accused murderers, the lynch mob that took Emmett away, after they basically confessed to the crime. It was published in Look magazine in January 1956. And you apparently have some problems with that story. And I can tell you, as a journalist, I'm also a lawyer, and bring these two areas of my experience together as a high form of advocacy. Really, we're advocating the truth here. And the issues that you have with the Look magazine, apart from the confessions, is that it distorts the story. And we know that journalists tend to get into an echo chamber and start reporting on other people's reports without ever going back to look at the source material. And that's part of the problem you have here. Did mm-hmm. the Look magazine author ever talk to you?
No, never talked to me at all.
And what is it about that story that disturbs you?
They portray, I knew him, I grew up with him, you know, next door to him, and we in out of each other's home, we didn't have to knock. And they portrayed him in such a negative way. I think they had to justify, because usually those stories that happen in the South, they just disappear. But this went all over. Now you got to justify or make the killers look not so bad. So they portrayed him as a bully. I'm not afraid of you guys. I've been with white women all the time, you know, that kind of stuff. And it was not Emmett at all. Here's a kid that's 14, just turned 14, just a few days prior, he was 13. And I know this is not Emmett, you know, and it bothered me. It still does, still bothered me, because some people would like to even believe it now that he was that kind of person. But the thing bothers me most is that, how can you take the law into your own hands? That's how they ever mention when people believe that he behaved as he did. They never talk about due process, and that bothered me, and it still bothers me.
So we talk about Emmett. A lot of people know Emmett Till as an icon, as a martyr in the civil rights movement. You knew him as a person, as you're suggesting here. You knew him. We all know Emmett Till. We know something about Emmett Till. You knew Bobo, yeah. The nickname you all had for him in growing up. Tell us about Bobo.
Fun-loving prankster, never had a dull day in his life. If you look at that picture, that smile, and that's him. That's him. I like to make people laugh, and I tell people he's a typical Leo. No offense to you Leos. But he had a great time. He enjoyed life, never had a dull day. And I remember I have a little sister. I was born, and my brother and Till was kind of tussling on who's going to push her. He was cared about children. And my little sister is named after his grandmother, Alma. And so he was that kind of person. I was talking to a girl that lives out in Colorado, Pueblo, Colorado, and she was saying Emmett came by her house one day, and he stuttered all the time. We don't portray him enough in his stuttering. He had polio. I got the copy of the news article in 1947. He had polio, and they left him with a stutter. And so he went by this girl's house. We lived in a small town, half a mile wide, about a mile and a half long, and there's a field there, and we play in the field. I play war games and stuff like that. So he went by to take her to the field to go play. And the mother said, no, snakes over there. He said, I kill all the snakes, you know. And she's still, that's what she remembers, how she remembers him now. Margaret Payne out in Pueblo, Colorado. So he was always concerned and had something going that's positive all the time in his life. Love animals, love people. And he was just a great guy. Child, love to make you laugh. He loved pranks and jokes, so he paid people to tell him jokes. We had a guy, it's an interesting story, a gentleman come from Louisiana, and there's something about those down south boys, they could tell those jokes. And he'd catch them, so the guy told us a joke about a man named O.T. Jones. So the next day, Emmett saw him, he couldn't think of his name. So he said, hey, O.T. Jones. And today, that guy's name is O.T. Jones. Nobody else knows nothing else. He changed the guy's name. O.T. Jones, and that's what we call him, O.T. Jones. People do not know his real name.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about Emmett Till. We develop, you know, his humanity, because then you can really appreciate what's been taken from us with his lynching. But clearly, if he's paying people for jokes, he was doing all right. He came from a middle-class family.
He was privileged. He was privileged, but I don't think he knew he was privileged. He didn't take advantage of it. He was not arrogant at all, you know.
I also wrote a book with his late mother during the last 6 months of her life, and of course she has all these wonderful stories about her son. As a journalist, we are fond of saying that, you know, if your mother tells you she loves you, check it out. So that's how I met Wheeler Parker 20 years ago, and we sat in the back of his barbershop at the time and talked to 8 or 9 of Emmett's closest childhood friends and cousins, and developed a sense of who he really was. He liked sports too, didn't he?
Yeah, he liked sports. He lost the championship game for us. We never forgot that.
So he was really good at it, or not?
We did forgive him. He was too slow.
But he wanted to be
on
the team.
He's going to be. He had left our school, and he came back. So he talked him into letting him play, and he lost the game. And we never forgot it. We forgave him, but we never forgot it.
So you didn't choose him anymore after that. So you all were close,
yes.
Very close. In fact, you said that his mother treated you as if you were his big brother. Yeah. You would go along everywhere he went.
Yes.
So when you were going to go to Mississippi in August 1955, he found out about it, and then what happened?
He would not let it rest, you know, because, of course, they knew Emmett and they knew the South, and they said, no, we can't let him go down there. They were afraid what did happen could happen. So back and forth, I was not privy to the conversation, but back and forth, they finally decided to let him go south with us, reluctantly, very reluctant. It's a big, big to-do about letting Emmett go south. And eventually they did let him go.
They were concerned because he didn't know the ways of the South?
He didn't have no idea. And if you never lived, even to you, if you never lived in the South or experienced that, you have no idea what it was really like. You could hear it and you could read about it, but if you didn't experience it, it's almost like it's unbelievable the things that went on. How can a person lose their life for reckless eyeball? And how can we experience the things that we experienced and the government never got involved? Hundreds of people hung, and every black family in the South has a story to tell. And no one believed. I told one of the writers, I said, we need to write about this. He said, who would confess? You know, of course, I was joking. I said, go get Strong Thurmond. Maybe he'll confess. He has a black daughter, look just like him. Maybe he'll say something positive or something that's worthwhile. I said, we come from Africa, one color, black. I said, how do we get all these different colors? And what happened to us? And we need to write about it. We don't write about it. We don't talk about it. But it's there. And black men was portrayed as rapists. I said, well, who was raping who? We got 13,000 African Americans passed for white every year. That's a lot of people. Even my daddy, sometimes they thought he was a Caucasian. My grandmother's. Yeah, his mother was listed as mulatto. So all my life, I said, man, we got part Indian. All black people want to have Indian in them. We've never been around Indians. Now, it's the European, she was listed as mulatto, but so I did my DNA. So I have no Indian whatsoever, not 1% Indian. And there's a lot of things we don't write about, we don't talk about, that's real. And that's the life of the South. You had to live it, though. And you're living, and all of a sudden, you got a half, we call them half-breed, I call them half-breed. There's a half-breed in the family. Where you come from? How my grandmother, it happened with my great-grandmother, and she said, man, the white people are getting humble. He said, they're living right here in the house with us. She didn't know that was from race mixing. She just thought people were really changing. But you had to live in the South. Even living there, you had a life to live. You didn't let it get you bogged down. It was a bump in the road, those things that happened to you. But we made progress. And I was mentioning it the other day in a talk in my little town. I live in a small town, half mile wide, mile and half long. And I said, I remember on this street here, you can count all the cars on your hand. I said, we've progressed and become so successful, you can't find a parking place now. So I was just trying to show them how far we've come in spite of all of the adversity that we face. In spite of, I think there was a survey that was done that said African Americans in America, if we were a nation out of 180 nations in the world, we would be number 7. We've got a lot, made a lot of progress. We've done a lot, and in spite of the pushback, in spite of not being able, being not let read, but the, not have the access to reading at one time, we come along. We did a lot of things, and we can do a lot more. And I try to tell people that everyone have a purpose in life. Find your purpose and get busy doing it. And that's what Mamie Till did. She lost her son. That didn't stop her. She says, like they don't exist. Very strong, powerful woman. She said, I got a story to tell. I got a job to do. And that's what she did. She got out there and she took a lemon and she made lemonade. Great example of what you should do when something negative happened to you.
Well, you mentioned that people had a way of getting beyond the trauma that they suffered in the South. And this is more than just a speed bump. This is something that affected the rest of your life. So let's get down to Mississippi now. And you are the reason Emmett wants to go. Mm-hmm. You're the reason he goes.
Right.
Down in Mississippi, tell us what happened from that Wednesday on.
Of course, Mississippi, some people think you pick cotton all year long. You can't pick cotton all year long. You got to have a planting and harvesting. But we got there in the fall, which is harvesting time in the South, especially Mississippi, in the South period. During harvest time, everybody worked. They got the cotton sacks and they pulled the little babies on the cotton sack. Everybody that hit town worked. And if you were caught in town not working, you going to Parchman Prison until the cotton picking season is over. You're going to be sentenced to whatever time you need to help gather in all the crops.
So you're sentenced to picking cotton.
Yeah. It's amazing, but
for somebody else.
Yeah. And they made money off it. It's hard to believe that that's where it was. And we survived and we made progress in the middle of it, you know.
So Emmett goes down for the vacation of a lifetime and he has to be put to work. Is that
right away. We got there on Sunday, Monday morning, we're in Cottonville. Emmett didn't do well.
he wasn't used to that.
He just was not. See, I had spent my 7 formative years there. I left when I was about 7. I'm 16 now, 7, right at 8. So I knew the ways of the South. I knew about picking cotton when I was 6 years old. I could pick 100 pounds of cotton. And the attitude of the South was to outwork the next guy. I come to Illinois, and in the North, it's who can do the less work and make the most money. So I talked that. I grew up with that, and so I had a barbershop, and they always said, Wheeler, you're a company man. I said, you better believe I'm a company man. I want you guys to keep your job so you can come here and pay for these haircuts, you know. I want the company to survive, so I'm a company man, you know. But anyway, Emmett's out there, and he just didn't do well in the cotton field. He was not cut out. He said, stay in your lane. That was not his lane. So he couldn't stay around town, so he'd stay with my grandmother in the house and help her cook or whatever she was doing there, but he was not cut out for the cotton field.
So you got there on Sunday, started working on Monday, mm-hmm. Tuesday, mm-hmm. Wednesday, and then Wednesday is when you go down uptown to Money, and yeah. This is the story that people have heard about, but you were there. Tell mm-hmm. us what happened.
And let's kind of paint a picture of Money. I passed through there the other day, looking to my left. I said, I just passed through town. That's how small it is. Not a stop sign, not a grocery store, not a post, nothing there. Just passed through town. And that's about, and we are 3 miles down the gravel road. In the south, you have the blacktop, gravel road, and the dirt road. And when you get to the dirt road, you're in the country. You're in the country where when the moon doesn't shine, you can't see your hand in front of your face. That's hard to imagine, but that's the fact of life. Because there's no moon, there's nothing to reflect, for the light to reflect off of. So we are about 3 miles down the gravel road, right at the dirt road. And of course, on the third day, that Wednesday, we went to, we call it going to town, but that's not the town town. Town town is Greenwood. That's where you go do all your shopping and meet your families from other communities and other plantations, because you're surrounded by plantations. You don't want to live a plantation life as a sharecropper. It is, even to think about the way the people were treated and the life of being on a plantation is mind-boggling even now. But in spite of that, we still survive. I got a magazine, Jet Magazine, and it was 1980 something. So they were looking for, kind of get off the subject just a little bit, and we can come. You can come back, or you can stop me when you want. But it's a fascinating story to me, and I kept it. And they were looking for the family, black family, that had the most children graduate from college. One guy had 19 children, 18 graduate from college. This is printed. This is documented. If you didn't have 10 graduate from college, you didn't make the score. It's amazing how much they did in spite of the condition. Of course, they went to black colleges and they got the degree, had good teachers, and it shows how much of what people can do in spite of. Great story. I keep that book, and if you want, you can look it up, and you'll find that it's very intriguing to hear. So we're back to that Wednesday, right?
You're getting a break. You've been working hard for a few days. You get a break. You go hang out at the store.
The thing about
the one, maybe two or three stores in the whole town.
I don't remember one. That's the one we went to. So we were there, and normally the problem with us and our trip is that when you send, they sent children south in droves every summer. I mean, but you always had an adult with you to ward off the trouble, because you got to get the yes sirs and no sirs, and you're going to be prodded, you're going to be questioned to see if you know the ways of the South. One thing about the South, they did not want you to forget the Southern mores. You didn't look at a white woman in the eye, yes sir, no sir, you had to do all of these things. I knew those things because I lived in the South. Emmett had no idea, as far as I'm concerned. His mother said she gave him a crash course to go South. But usually you had an adult with you to ward off these troubles. They would correct things right away. We didn't have that. My uncle, who has use of the car, he's 16, he's younger than I am. And we're the oldest two there. So when I get to the store, I don't know if you want me to go into that or not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we get to the store and we're around there. People are gathered from the little local plantation and playing checkers. And so I decided to go into the store to purchase some things. And in the store, all of the goods are behind this. You have a counter in front of you about 4 feet wide. And everything you want is back on the wall. The storekeeper will bring it to you. So I purchased what I had, what I wanted, an image walked in. I said, oh my goodness. I said to my heart, I said just like that, my heart's boom. I'm in Mississippi. I know where I'm at. Emmett has no idea where he's at. I'm thinking, I hope he got his language together. I knew it could be a problem. So I left him in the store. Nothing happened. And there's so many stories been told about what happened. It's mind-boggling even now. Anyone ever privy to seeing the Eyes on the Prize? Anybody saw that piece? Well, my cousin is telling the story of what happened with the Eyes on the Prize. And he was not there at all. And I'm seeing all of these publications and documentaries, and I feel helpless because I can't do anything to warrant this. Oh, I can't do anything to correct. Again, I'm thinking grown folks don't tell lies, they tell the truth. And my cousin Curtis is telling the story, and he was not there at all, what happened at the store. So many stories went out. So Emmett is in there. I left him in there. My Uncle Simeon, who's 12, Emmett's 14, and I'm 16. My Uncle Simeon went into the store to be with him. My Uncle Maurice sent him in there to be with him. So they come out. Nothing happened while they're there, but all these stories have been told as to what happened there. And I just, like I said, it's mind-boggling to me too, for people to believe the things that were said as opposed to the people who were in there with him. My Uncle Simeon was with him. I was there. And they came out of the store. Nothing happened at all. Some said he whistled in the store. So later, Mrs. Bryant comes out. She's 21. She comes out of the store. She goes to her left. And Emmett, as he will do, loves to make people laugh. So he gives this big wolf whistle. We talk. His mother never asks us what happened. We never talk to her about what happened. She has a different version of why he whistled. And Chris can deal with that later, but when he whistled, being in Mississippi in 1955, we knew that it was a death sentence. Fear gripped us, and no one said, let's go. We made a beeline for the car. Now Emmett is afraid. Dusk dark, someone dropped a cigarette in the car. My uncle, we moved till we found the cigarette, and down the gravel road we go. And there's a car behind us. He said, man, they're after. And we are afraid because we know what he just did. And we know people were killed for reckless eyeball. You could be killed for nothing. And you could get no help from the police, the government. And you're just in a helpless situation. So the car's behind us. And they said, someone's after us. My uncle sped up and we pulled to the side, jumped out of the car, ran through the cotton field, and the car went right by. So we regroup at the edge of the road, and Emmett is afraid. Said, don't tell Papa. That's my grandfather, his great uncle. Don't tell Papa. So we agree not to tell. But then there's a girl there named Ruth. Ruth is 18. She said, look, this is not over. You're all going to hear some more about this. I know those people. They killed people before, nothing done. We were not aware of that. So we did this on a Wednesday, Thursday went by, Friday went by. So we kind of forgot about it, you know. And that's what happened that Wednesday.
And so now we get to Saturday night. All the work is done. Mm-hmm. And so you all go to hang out and have a good night on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And then what happens at that point?
Well, on Saturday in the South, every Saturday, you get a little money. They were paying us. We were working in someone else's field, so we got made a little money. I think I made about $7-8. So I had a little money in my pocket. And people would come from all these little hamlets and towns and plantations to Greenwood. We're in a big city now, having a great time. They're sipping on their little beers and to the theater and buying hot dogs. But about 12 o'clock, you have to leave. Police going to come out and say, hey, boy, you're going to be late for Sunday school in the morning, aren't you? So you got to go. That's your signal to go, and you better get going too, because something's gonna happen to you if you don't. So we stopped at a place, plantation on the way. They had juke joints. I don't know. Any of y'all know what a juke joint is? Yeah, you know what a juke. Okay, we stopped by the juke joint, and out the juke joint they partying, and they had some little clear liquor. I found out it was liquor in a glass. Y'all know what that is, right? Moonshine White Lightning. So I had a couple swallows of that, and it seemed like holes was in the ground.
It remind us how old you were at this point.
Huh?
How old were you at that
point? I was 16. Okay. So White Lightning, and I don't know, but it's no good for you. I was scared. I had an uncle got drunk, and he put me against drinking, period, you know, because he acted so terrible when he got drunk. I mean, he put the fear of God in me. So we leave there on the way home and get home about 12 o'clock. And on the way home, my Uncle Maurice hits a dog that's lying in the street. And the dog is yelping, and Emmett Till is crying. Bobo, we call him Bobo. Bobo was crying and because he hit the dog. And we finally got home about 12 o'clock. And he wanted me to go into what happened.
Yeah, so you everybody goes to bed. Uh-huh. Lights are out in the house. You talked about how dark it is in Mississippi in the Delta when there's no moon, and now you have no lights. So about 2:30 in the morning, you hear something.
We're living in this house, and everybody called it a shack. It was not a shack. It was a former landowner's home, a screened-in porch, wide, and you got four bedrooms. Off of the porch, you go off of the screening porch, you go right to the bedrooms, one room behind the other. No hallways. I never saw a bedroom where you have no hallways to go to them. But anyway, it was a former landowner's home, and they took advantage of all the space. So I hear these people talking about 2:30 in the morning, and they talking about what happened at the store. I said, and I come from a very religious family. Church I passed and outside of my grandmother, Emmett Till's grandmother's house, Monty. And I said, I'm getting ready to die. I said, God, I talk to God like I'm talking to you. When death is imminent, it's just something happens to you. You don't need a preacher. You don't need a missionary. All this training and teaching that I had come up.
You thought you were going to die because you heard what they were saying at the door?
Oh, I heard them talking. So you got two boys here from Chicago. We want to talk to the fat boy that did the talking at the store. They didn't say anything about a whistle. Then I said, God, these people are going to kill us. I'm getting ready to die. And my relationship with you is not right. This is because of where I was taught, I was brought up. And I need to get that right. I said, if you just let me live, I'm going to get my life together. I thought about saw a documentary, the soldier was in World War II, the ship had broken up out into the deep sea, and there was a shark coming his way. He said, God, if you just let that shark go another way. He said, I'm going to go home. You think about all the wrong you ever done when death is imminent. He said, I'm going to go home and start treating my little brother right. And I'm going to marry a young lady, and I'm going to treat her right. You want to get real holy and righteous with God because you're finna die and leave. So, and that's where I was. It's like, I've just let me there. I'm shaking and praying, and after a while, they come my way. I hear them coming my way. You can't see. You got your eyes bucked, but it's dark as a thousand midnights. No lights on. This guy entered in with a pistol in one hand and a flashlight in the other. 16-year-old lying there shaking, my uncle in bed with me, didn't wake up. And I closed my eyes to be shot, and they didn't shoot me. I opened my eyes and they're going past me. And of course, the next room, my uncle, my cousin there didn't wake up, and they caught Emmett in the third room. And it was just pure hell in the house. The atmosphere was so dark, and it just was a terrible place to be. Something you don't want to experience in your life, because you know you could be killed at any minute. Of course, they left with him this last time we saw him alive. He wanted to put on his socks, I believe, and it was pure hell in that house that night, that morning.
So it was a night of terror. There's no question about it.
Oh, you got to find another word. It's worse than terror. You just can't believe the atmosphere and how you felt, you know, it was horrible.
You thought you were going to die, but I guess everybody thought that they could.
I thought we were going to, all was going to die. Yeah, I thought we were going to.
Everybody could be killed.
But the thing about it, my uncle in bed with me didn't wake up. My cousin in the next room didn't wake up. My uncle in the room with Emmett didn't wake up. So they slept through it. And even after they left, no one said anything to anyone. And it seemed like daylight would never come. I got up and put my shoes on. I said, they're coming back. And we live near the woods. I had my escape plan for the woods. And I didn't want to do it barefooted, so I did put my shoes on. But we didn't say anything to each other. And my grandmother would not stay. My grandfather had to take her to her brother's house in Sumner, where they had the court. That's what he took her to. It was a terrible, you don't want to experience anything like that.
So before daybreak, though, as they're taking him out, something happens at the truck.
Yeah, they took him out to the truck. My grandfather said he heard it. They asked, is this the one? Is he the one? Because they said, we're going to bring him back if he's not the one. So he heard like a woman's voice say, he's the one. And we think that it was Carolyn Bryant. And we thought so then, we still think so, but you have no way of proving it.
And that's the point. You hear all the facts of the story. And one of the things we tried to do in connecting this up is to show that this was in a context. You can't begin to talk about racism as a thing in and of itself. It's within a power hierarchy, and that's the power hierarchy that existed in Mississippi, where white people could get away with murdering black people, and that's what happened. There are certain things I just wanted to pick up on quickly, because I think we're going to be getting into Q&A soon. One, the woman's voice, and we do connect that up to Carolyn Bryant. In ways that are developed. One, she talks at the trial. They take her husband and brother-in-law into custody and bring them to trial within just a few weeks, which you know is too short to build a real murder case. So this was just a show trial. But in that show trial, Carolyn Bryant testifies of all these horrible things that Emmett Till, she says, expressed in the store. Now, we know he didn't have enough time in the store to do all the things that she said. And you heard about the stutter. How bad was that stutter?
All the time. All the time, every day, all day. He stuttered. And the things that she was not aware that he stuttered. That's what she said, you know. So we know she's lying through her teeth. But
so there's no way you could hear him talk and not know that he was stuttering. Yeah, and there's no way that he could have said all the things that she said if you know, when he had that stutter. But we tracked up through the records statements she made to the defense attorneys just a few days after the abduction and the lynching. And in that statement to the lawyer, she doesn't say any of the things she said in court just a few weeks later. So the story begins to grow from the time Emmett goes into the store and whatever she said to her husband that excited him enough to go and kidnap Emmett, to the point of giving the statement to the lawyer, to the point of the trial, and then we fast forward to what she's saying now. The reason this book was written is because we were called by the FBI down to Mississippi to talk about a development in 2017 when Timothy Tyson, a lecturer at Duke, wrote a book in which he says he's quoting Carolyn Bryant when she says in his book that part is not true. And what he says she's referring to is the testimony she gave at trial, where she's exaggerating the contact and talking about Emmett Till as if he's a rapist. Mm-hmm. That's all they needed to hear in Mississippi, obviously. Mm-hmm. So we pick that apart. We look at all the documents that the FBI shared with us. The Department of Justice was involved. The U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Mississippi was involved. The district attorney for that county was involved. And we meticulously went through all the documents to show a few things. One, connecting up the dots to Carolyn Bryant, we believe was in the truck at the time. It just didn't amount to evidence that could be introduced at trial. How she has grown the story over time and the way she tells it in her manuscript, the unpublished manuscript, which we had several years before it actually was released online. And Timothy Tyson also had access to that because he was helping her edit her book, which he denies, but we had a copy of the manuscript that has the track changes with his initials and the date he was making his comments. And in one of the passages, she describes again what she says happened at the store. And there was a line there that really struck us where she says, I thought I was going to be molested. Mm. She's never said that way before. Mm. And he edits it so that it reads now, I feared I was going to be molested. Mm. So he's actually strengthening her narrative and then turning around and saying that she recanted, which of course she's denied now. We participate in the investigation over the course of 4 years, a four-year ride along with the FBI, and they're sharing all these documents with us. And in the end, they issue a report that says they found no credible evidence that she ever said what he published in the book. So this ties into, again, the narrative that has been so disturbing to Reverend Parker over the years, where people have completely distorted the story. But we put it in a power context as well, because again, you can't really understand racism in this country without understanding the power context that it exists in. People are defined in certain ways, identified in certain ways to justify their placement in this power hierarchy. And we see this going on now. So this book is in conversation with what we're experiencing now, as you see in so many jurisdictions now, so many states, people trying to erase history in order to rewrite it in a way that justifies the things that are going to be going on now. So this is, we think, the value of this book. Not only do you have the core story, but you have the personal story of Reverend Parker, and in a context that we think people need to understand in this contemporary moment as we try to meet the challenges of what some people are saying is creeping authoritarianism, democratic backsliding. What do we need to understand about our condition now on the cusp of a new demographic reality in which white is no longer going to be the majority here? There's going to be no ethnic or racial majority in this country. And some people clearly are having a little bit of trouble navigating this new terrain. And we see the results of that. So one final thing I want to just get to on a personal note before we open up to questions, and that is that this book is kind of on parallel paths, right? There's the investigation, which drives the memory, and the memory, which informs the investigation. So quite a unique telling of a story that hasn't been shared with people before, but about power and about power over the narrative, and how so many people have taken control of the narrative to tell their story or to tell a story that elevates them in some way. But on a personal note, there's something I know you've struggled with forever, and that is that Emmett Till went down to Mississippi with you. You were the reason he went down there. Mm-hmm. You went down together, but you came back alone.
Yeah, it really bothered me because during his mother's lifetime, when I'm around her, I guess I had survivor's guilt, but we never talked about it, and she never really asked what happened. She had a version of what happened, and she told it. But it, by me coming back, it gave me guilt, and I really didn't know how to react around her like I probably really should. And I think also, while you were talking, I was thinking about Carolyn Bryant. Supposed to have told Timothy Tyson that she lied on Emmett, and that gave me closure. I mean, I was elite. I was very excited about that. And of course, Tyson, no one went after him, but he couldn't find the transcript. He couldn't find anything to back up what he was saying. He was a college professor and a writer. So I still like to think sometimes she did confess. She's living. And I hope to hear her one day confess. It's not too late, you know. That would help bring closure to me.
So there can be no justice for Emmett. Mm. Justice would have meant that he came home alive and intact. But there can be accountability. And that's the hope that carries you forward, that at some point somebody's going to be accountable.
Yes.
And in a way, we all have to be accountable, right? We have to know these stories in order to understand what happened in the last century that brought us to the point now of reflecting on where we're going from this point on. So we hope that people have a chance to dive into this story and get that meaning. And the accountability now is with us. What are we gonna do from this moment on to keep the promise that was made about what this society was gonna be, and to make sure that we don't lose that as we move forward. So with that, I guess we can take questions.
Didn't the Southern writer William Bradford Huey pay the murderers for their story? Weren't they paid cash?
Yes. They were paid, well, $4,000 was paid. The lawyers got part of that. The killers, we can say they're killers now, The killers got the remainder of that. And $4,000 in 1955 is about $38,000 today. So you can just imagine what a payday that was for them. He was criticized for checkbook journalism, but he didn't care.
The husband, Rich Samuels, some of y'all may remember Rich Samuels, NBC Channel 5. He did a documentary 30 years after Emmett's kidnapping and murder. And in his documentary shows him going to talk to one of the murderers. He said he didn't get anything. And he told Rich Samuel, if you're coming down on a story, come with a pocket full of money. Rich told him, said, journalists do not pay for stories. So that's the kind of people that we were dealing with. And it's just kind of ironic how things happen. And even in Mrs. Bryant's telling of the story, you don't take the law into your own hands. Don't take the law into your own hands.
Yeah, Roy Bryant, her husband, was quoted as saying, you know, everybody's made money off this story. And that's not true. But he said, everybody's made money off this story. It's time for me to make some money as well, even though he got that that payoff in 1955. And we even have reason to believe that Carolyn Bryant was writing the book in order to have a payday herself. So, yeah, that's where we are on this. We looked at the archives, William Bradford Huey's papers that are at Ohio State, and only a couple of other writers have ever done that. And we see how he was negotiating to get the story. He actually first offered Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, a story in book form to expose the atrocities of the South. And Roy Wilkins never responded to him, so he flipped the script, took it to the lawyers for the killers and said, we're going to write an expose on what these Negroes are doing to try to change the way of life in the South. And that's the story they wound up publishing. We also track the language that's used in the quotes in that article, the quotes that are attributed to the killers, one of the killers anyway, J.W. Milam. And we see that actually that tracks what one of the lawyers had been saying. So there's reason to believe, and other people have agreed with us on this, that the lawyers actually dictated part of the story that's been attributed to the killers. This is all about power. And what they were saying in those quotes, these lawyers who are part of the establishment in this town, this county, is that they did not want their way of life to change. This is a way of life that was profitable for them. And as you heard, was oppressive to so many people. There were 19,000 residents in Tallahatchie County in 1955, the year that the trial took place in Tallahatchie County. 19,000 residents, and two-thirds of the population was Black. 20,000 were Black, and not a single Black person was registered to vote. This is what this story is all about. The threat of change with Brown versus Board of Education that just had been decided, people feeling that they were going to lose power because they had to share power. And we see now that that's on a parallel with what's going on right now. And that's why this is an important story.
Is there any plan, or maybe I could have missed it in some of the literature, to bring probably civil charges against Carolyn? I haven't kept up with everything, but has that been brought up, or where is are people with that?
I'll let Chris answer.
I also served as a lawyer when we were negotiating. Yeah, the statute of limitations has passed on anything that could possibly be brought here. Civil action, criminal action, and we looked at everything to see what could be done. We not only were part of the storytelling that helped to inform the investigation, but because of the level of trust and confidence that we'd established with the authorities, by not leaking, you know, agreeing not to put anything out there until the investigation was done, they were giving us more and more and more information, and also included us in discussions of the strategy. So we tried every possibility with respect to suggestions about things that could be done. But yeah, in the end, they didn't have enough. We even at some point, this is true confessions here, said, well, you know, maybe she doesn't know that she can't be charged with some, why don't we charge her and then she can at least come forward and confess. And as you heard, that would have been at least some sort of some level of satisfaction. But there is this thing called, unlawful prosecution, and the prosecutors would have been called up on charges if they had tried to charge something they knew they didn't have evidence for.
And you still have people who wants her arrested, and they can arrest her, but they can't charge her with anything.
There is still a warrant.
Some family members are really, they really want her to be arrested. And we had two grand jury hearings, 2043 and just 2018 and 19, and both had found no evidence to charge her, both grand juries. And so we accepted, we met with the FBI, Civil Rights Division, District Attorney out of Mississippi, because only Mississippi, that district, could charge her with anything. And they came up with nothing. Grand jury that found no true bill. So we went on and accepted what they said. But they said it's open. If you come up with anything, bring it to us. But we have some family members who really, they said she just need to be arrested anyway to harass her. But they said we could arrest her, but what we're going to charge her with.
So the statute is run on any criminal charge, and there's not enough evidence to pursue a civil case, wrongful death or manslaughter or something in that area. We're constantly thinking about the possibilities. The warrant, though, we have a copy of the warrant that was issued for her arrest, her husband, her brother-in-law. It was issued actually the day after Emmett Till was taken. So in order to issue a warrant, you have to have probable cause. We searched the record to see what they would have considered to be probable cause at that point, because perhaps there's some evidence there. They actually name her in the warrant. And the sheriff at the time was quoted in the press as saying he didn't serve the warrant because she was a young mother with two kids. He didn't want to trouble her.
How do you both handle people in your lives now who are not honest, they're not truth tellers?
Wow, that's
I'll let the minister talk about that.
From day one, I pastored a church that started in Emmett Till's grandmother's house in 1926. And that was one of the major teachings in the church, forgiveness and truth telling. And so that was part of our nature to forgive. So in 2003, if you watch a reconciliation speech that Mamie Till was making, she was at a reconciliation meeting, and she said, God took hate out of my life 47 years ago. She said, I can't let those people control my life. And by me coming in under that same banner, I found out that we both were on the same page. I always preface my speeches with, I'm not here to stir up animosity, ill will or hate, just to talk about history. Can we talk about history? But we can't let hate control. Hate destroys the hater. And I speak to a lot of school kids and adults too. I say, how you feel when you wake up in the morning and say, I hate my mama, I hate my dad, I hate my husband, I hate my wife, I just hate everybody. How do you feel? So we can't afford the luxury of hate. I said that once in my high school, Argo High School. I said, don't hate. And the little girl said, appreciate. So now we have this saying, wherever I go, don't hate, appreciate. We said about three times. And because most of your hate or trial to be hate, it comes from your family, not from another race. It's within your own household. Your foes of them are your own household. So we tried to use that opportunity to tell people you can't afford the luxury of hate. Hate destroys the hater. So religiously, we were taught to forgive. And she said she forgave. And I know you have to forgive, because if you don't forgive, you won't be forgiven. And so some guy said, well, how can you not hate? It's a job. It's a responsibility to hate. It takes a lot of energy to hate. And you die from hate before you will from love. So that's sometimes I take that opportunity to share those thoughts.
And forgiveness, it requires some kind of recognition that something has been done wrong, right? So that's mm-hmm. part of the truth seeking. Mm-hmm. And in journalism, mm-hmm. we try to verify wherever possible. Assertions of fake news notwithstanding, we're all about the truth and getting at the truth, and not just the truth with respect to the facts, but the context in which those facts live, and that's what we're trying to do here. So we talk about media literacy, you know, people not just looking at one source, that confirmation bias that, you know, just reinforces what you already believe, but looking at multiple sources of information. And journalists, sadly, lazy journalists are guilty of the same thing, of looking at sources that have established certain mm-hmm. stories and not going back and doing independent research, which is what we tried to do with our work. It's what we did, actually. So. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to thank both of you for this wonderful discussion and for telling your story and helping us to remember. Thank you all for being here, and let's give our guests one more round of applause.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Kate Smeissner and Nicole Shawan Jr. discuss their contributions to The Sentences That Create Us, Crafting a Writer's Life in Prison. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.